Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Razor Riffs with Keith Razor and Alan Lee, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Hey guys, welcome to the show. A couple announcements before we get into it. I'm going to be at the Irvine Improv with Jay Moore, July 26th to the 28th, so come see us. You can buy tickets at www.irvine.improv.com. And other than that, that's all I got. Now I'm going to introduce the one and only Alan Lee.
Hello.
Hello?
Yes, hello. I'm glad to be here, and I don't have much to say other than I will be at the Tribal Cafe downtown, and I've been booked there for as long as I can take it. It's an open mic.
Oh, and that's great. Thanks for advertising an open mic on the radio.
You're going to demean me?
I'm not demeaning you. I'm just making fun of you.
What am I supposed to do?
All right.
That's all I got.
And we have a great guest here, guys. I'm going to introduce him, but I've always wanted to do this. You've seen him from The Maya Mancia, The Heartbreak Kid, which is one of my favorite movies.
That's a good one.
And Disney's The Proud Family, the great Carlos Mencia. How you doing, Carlos?
Hey, thank you.
I'm good, man. I'm glad to be here, man. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for doing it.
I love talking. I never shut up.
Oh, please go on. That's what we're all about.
You gave Alan Lee a scare because we were supposed to start at 2. And he was like, oh, where's Carlos?
They had told me. I'm 10 minutes down the street. Yeah. They had told me that it was tomorrow.
So. Oh, really?
But,
oh,
yeah, that's all. But I'm glad we got to do it. I got it all worked out.
Yeah. Because I don't know CPR, so I couldn't give him a...
Oh, no, that's okay.
It's okay.
I don't know how many times...
I'm okay.
I don't know how many people do that. I love interviews, man. I love getting it out there.
Beautiful.
Like, it's fun, you know, when you do as much stand-up as I do.
Yeah.
It's always fun to get into different forms of showing your, you know, your artistic integrity, so to speak. You know, this is a different way of being interesting than being on stage.
Yeah.
And I'm always very welcoming of it, you know, especially because they're all different. A podcast is completely different from doing an afternoon radio than doing a morning radio than doing a, you know, they all have their very distinct characteristics. You know, you get 4 minutes on, you know, ABC affiliate in Jacksonville, Mississippi. It's going to be completely different than what I'm going to do, you know, in any other format. So it's really fun to be able to, you know, encompass all those. So I dig it.
I like podcasts because Al and I both, we have Asperger's syndrome.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so like it really helps with our comedy just to talk and you know,
but
stuff like that.
Sure.
You might have told
Carl. Oh, he also has ADHD or something like that.
This was a recent fucking discovery that I made about an hour ago.
That you have ADHD?
ADHD, yeah. I just wanted to make that clear.
No, listen. Okay, so here's an example of the way that can go about. I have a friend who... was a huge pothead, and he was my road manager, Joey. And after being on the road with me for probably a decade or so, he just kind of missed Corpus Christi and his family and stuff. So he went back to Corpus. He got a job working as a safety manager at one of the big plants over there, the refineries. Mm-hmm. Well, they told him like you can't do any drugs, so he stopped smoking weed. And he really quickly found out that he's huge ADHD. He had no idea that he was self-medicating with marijuana and the effects that it had on him. So, but I knew that there was something wrong with him because he would smoke a joint and then be like, oh, I'm inspired. I'm going to go work out. And I'd be like, what? What are you talking? Where are you going? What is wrong with you? You know, so he would smoke weed and just everybody else is passed out or not wanting to move or just, and he's just like, I got some. Well, what we realized is he normally has a shitload of thoughts in his head.
Sure, sure.
And he's like, no, this, and no, that, and no, this, and no, that, and no, this, and no, that. And weed made him able to focus on one thought.
You're scaring me.
Where weed, what it does to people that don't have that, is it makes them not be able to connect dots, right?
Oh, my God.
So I get high. I can't connect dots. Sure. I see somebody smoke a joint before they go on stage, and I'm like, how do you do that? How do you continue a flow when I go on stage, I have no idea what I'm going to say, and I have no idea where the show is going to go. And you know, every joke is kind of like look at it like a tree growing. It comes out, and there's the trunk, and I tell a joke, and then I go, oh, this branch got to go to the left because I got to make them go to the right, but I got to go to the left before I go to the right because you're not ready for that kind of joke yet. And then I go there, and then I inevitably come back, and then every little dot is like a bunch of arms that come out, and at the end you look at it and go, oh, it's a fucking tree. You know what I mean?
Wow.
But at first, it's like almost that. Like connecting the dots. Oh, please. But where those dots go,
music to my ears.
I don't know.
I thought you were going to say something completely different. Like, so my road manager, he used to smoke pot. Now he doesn't. Then he started smoking crack or something.
No, no. I would have been different. No, I was connected into the ADHD and the fact that there's a lot of undiagnosed out there. Yeah. And then there's a lot of...
Thank you.
ADD diagnosis, which the reason why ADHD was brought up not too long ago is because the overdiagnosis of ADD, so that when people with the real came in, you know what I mean? Sure. It came in. It's kind of like people that say they're on the spectrum, but they're not. They're just weird or different or abstract. Sure. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But they want that. They want to say that, like, no, I'm on the spectrum. And it's like, dude, being on the spectrum is a real thing. It's not just, I feel uncomfortable around people. There's much more to it than that shit.
Well, see, it's funny you mention that, because now that I'm older, like, especially a lot of comics, they think, oh, he's not on the spectrum. He's just that weird guy, you know? But it's like, if you knew me when I was a kid, I was very nonverbal.
Sure.
And stand-up made me verbal.
Right.
You know, and so like I still have a speech stutter and all that stuff.
Sure.
You know? So,
but for you, it's not just a feeling. It's a part of your being.
Yeah.
And the difference is that, and I have family members with Asperger's, and you know, we didn't realize that they had Asperger's until probably 10, maybe 12 years ago. So before that, we knew that there was something hugely different.
Yeah.
About this, you know, this family member of ours. We just knew it. We just had no idea what it was.
I met you like 8 years ago. You did a show for autism at the Fox Theater in Fullerton. Maybe it was 9 years ago.
Yeah.
So that's when I met.
Oh, that's the first time I met AB.
Yeah.
That's right. I remember that show.
Yeah.
Nice. Tig was on that show. Yeah, I think so, right?
I remember George Lopez, not the famous one, though. No, George Perez. George Perez, yeah.
Yeah, it was fun. That was fun, man. Yeah. God, I remember that. Wow, that's so weird.
Yeah, so like I remember things like that, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like I also know like all the presidents. Like I could say George Washington to Donald Trump like that.
Yeah, that's awesome.
That's awesome. Man?
Yeah, it's in your head. I get it.
I don't know any of their accomplishments, but
it doesn't matter.
A lot of people don't.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't. You know. You know the thing is that what you realize, like you know, when you, the older you get, or at least the older I get, the more people I meet, the more I travel, the more I go around. You know, the more at ease I feel with my surroundings, because you just get to meet everybody. One of the coolest things, you know, I have is I was in Miami about a month and a half ago.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, about a month and a half ago. Cinco de Mayo weekend. And it was so bizarre because there were these guys. I when I'm on the road, I do this thing where if you get VIPs, you get a meet and greet before the show.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. So, and I do it because I want to give people a chance to, you know, meet me before the show, and they don't have to wait in line and all that kind of stuff. So literally, if you buy a t-shirt at the end of the show, you could have spent $25 and paid for VIP and not only got the meet and greet before, but a little more time with me, and you would have got preferred seating. So you could show up late and you still get front row seats or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, these four kids all on the spectrum came up, and one of them gave me a sign that it was an acronym. My name, Carlos, was spelled out, and then next to each letter was an inspirational thing that they were saying. It was just so like so cool, because I showed it to a friend of mine, and he's like, "Who gave you that?" He didn't say it in a positive way. He was like, "That's some simple shit. Who would do that?" And I said, "As a kid on the spectrum," and then he kind of reversed his shit and went, "Oh, well, you know, I didn't mean it." I'm like, "Yeah, you did. You're being a dick. You're, you know, somebody who's trying to say something nice. You were, instead of just accepting how nice it is, you were going to parse it and try to say, well, why did they use those words? Or could have said something different? Or who does that? Or who brings that to a show?" Mm-hmm. And for me, it was, it was why I do those meet and greets before the show, because I'm always, always, always inspired by people that I see before the shows. Because I might be in a bad mood, you know, sometimes I might have gotten bad news. My parents are aging. You know, I don't get good news all the time. You know, sometimes it's your mom took a turn for the worst type stuff. And, you know, you're just not, I'm a human being, man. I have my emotional limitations as well. But I'm telling you, when people are lined up to see me perform before a show, and that happiness I see in their eyes, that looking forward to what I'm going to make them feel, that just erases all the bullshit. And it just makes me realize, okay, this is why I do it. This is what it's about. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
These four kids that are you know, coming to see me perform. And it was so funny because there was a really awkward moment in the show where, it's a really big stage, and there's a monitor like right in the middle, right in front of the people. It's pointing in my direction, but it's still right in front.
Yeah.
And I screamed, and I saw the look on this kid, and he grabbed his ears, and I went, "Oh shit, you're very sound sensitive."
Yeah.
And I said, "Hey man, I don't think that I can lower these." And then I said to the manager, "Are there seats like a little further back where he can be, where it's not going to be so loud?" And he was like, "Yeah, there are." And like literally as he said, "Yeah," before they are, the two kids got up and walked toward the back like immediately. And the whole audience was kind of like, "What the fuck is going on here?" And I said to him, "Oh, God, sorry, guys. These guys are on the spectrum and they're very sensitive to sound. So they want to go to the back. They still want to watch the show, but they just don't want to be up here where it's, you know, so loud for them." And then the other two were like, "No, we're good." And they stayed. And it was an interesting moment because half of the, you know, a big portion of the audience had no idea what was going on. And they were just so freaked out. And the minute I said these kids are on the spectrum, like they all kind of were like, "Oh, fuck, what do we do now? Yeah. How do we react? What do we do?" And I was like, "Guys, it's the show's going to be fine, dude. His ears hurt. I saw it. I want him to have a good time." And then they moved on, and then everything was good, and the show was great. And I got a standing ovation, and it was an awesome show. But to me, those moments are interesting, not because of how I interpret them as much as it allows me to see how people are really feeling, you know, because people's comfort or discomfort with regards to material says so much about who they are as a crowd, as a group, not as much as individuals. I tend to look at crowds as one big giant being, one big, you know, homogenous, even though it's not, it usually turns out to be that way. It's the phenomenon of doing two shows in a row, and you do a specific joke in a specific way, exactly the same for both shows, and one kills,
and the other one crickets, yeah,
right, and that's because somehow, when these people got together, their energies converged into one big group, and they, for some fucking reason, all think this is funny or all think it's not funny.
I don't know
what that dynamic is, because it's not, I don't think that there's anybody in the world that can explain to you how that
occurs. I think that they should start shows, like, because, you know, when I opened for Norm, you know, like, Norm taught me everything, you know? So I think that when they start shows, they should do a 7 o'clock show and then a 9 o'clock show instead of an 8 and a 10, because the 9 o'clock, the late shows are usually that, "Oh, it's not funny yet," until the end. You know what I mean?
Right. Well, what you realize is, here's what I realize. All right. So Thursday night shows are very smart people who are really big fans, because they're coming to the first show of the week, right?
Yeah.
And they got tickets for it. They're excited. They're there to see you. Good. Like, Thursday night crowds are really, really good introductory crowds to whatever city you're going to. Friday's first show crowds are usually a really good mix of people, you know, some rich. I mean, you know, it's a pretty good, like, semblance of what America is and that city is, whatever that racial makeup of that city, that economic makeup. It's pretty descriptive. They're fun, a little tired, but they're good. The late show on Friday is always the craziest show.
Yeah.
Because those people are tired. And if the show is late enough, if the show's at 10 or 10:30, they drank before they got there.
Yeah,
they had a drink before they got
there. Like a yard house.
Right. And then they have two drinks right outside the bar of whatever club you're at. So they're three drinks in by the time you get on stage, and then they're going to have two more drinks.
Yeah.
Five drinks for the average person is a fuckload of alcohol.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Those are the crazy people. Yeah. Those are the ones that are going to yell shit out. Those are the ones where you're going to get a heckler. Those are the ones where somebody's going to get kicked out. Mm-hmm. That's just the pattern of that show. Saturday's first show is usually the oldest. Those are the older people, bought their tickets a billion years ago. They're great crowds. They love what you do. Some of them are there to see the night, but that's usually like the best kind of a mix of a crowd. Second show is on Saturday. Those people want to party, but they're not crazy. They're not tired. They pace themselves. They went to dinner first. They're a good crowd. A lot of energy, a lot of fun. Sunday crowds are usually the intellectuals, really smart people. Sunday crowds are the shows where I don't have to animate it too much.
Really?
I can just let the words play in themselves and they get it. They don't need to be spoon-fed the material with a lot of, you know, craziness or physicality or anything. I can slow those shows down and let that the material and the essence of it kind of just dissipate into them, and they kind of just through osmosis kind of feel it. It's a really fun, for me, the dynamic of doing four nights a week in that respect when I'm on the road is really fun, because it gives me that arch from what I told you in the beginning to those Sunday crowds that are just so, so, so smart, so great. Even though the energy isn't that.
Yeah.
I learned, because I record all my shows and I talk to people after the shows, I've learned that those Sunday shows, in early on in my career, I would go, man, I didn't do as well as the week. Shit, what happened? And then they would come up to me and they would say, man, that's the funniest shit I've ever seen. I've been coming here, you know, for 5 years, and you're the funniest dude I've ever seen. All of those kind of moments. And I was like,
but you felt you didn't have a good set.
Not that I didn't have a good set, comparably.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Compared to the Saturday night's first and second shows, this show was not, you know, I can't, because. Okay, so when I record, I see two different graphs, right, on my computer. One of them is me talking, and those are big spikes, right? Yeah, The other one is a constant, like, fat, kind of a staticky-looking thing in the middle of it. That's their laughter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the thinner and shorter, you know what I mean? The thinner and shorter. I'm so grabbing my middle finger too. But you know what I'm saying? The thinner and shorter that is, the less they're laughing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I want that to be thick and big.
Sure.
Yeah. And it is thick and big on those shows. On these shows, it's not. And so I was like, there's the proof.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's right there. Look at the graph. But it wasn't. It's that they're not, you know, they're taking in material intellectually as well as that. So Sunday shows are the shows where I get I got that, or can we talk about this later? Hey, can I have a moment with you after, and we can talk about that thing that you said about the this and this and that. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, Saturday shows are like, he was awesome, it was great, I loved it. Sure. Oh fuck, the joke about the Mexican lady at McDonald's was great. You know what I mean? Yeah, sure. That's their thing. Yeah. You know, on Sunday they'll say, wow, I really loved the way you did that story, and it's so relevant to everything, but you never made it political. You never made it about right or left. You just let the essence of that, and, you know, that's the same fucking joke. It's just, you know what I mean? So I'm like, all right, is it this or is it that? But, you know, once you've been doing it as long as I have, what I've realized is no matter what I try to do, I can only go so far as to dictate what the audience is supposed to feel.
Right.
At a certain point, they're just going to feel what they want to feel.
That's true.
That's it. That's, you know, so I try, like every one of us, to manipulate that as best I can. And dude, I use every possible trick in the book, from using the mic, from screaming, from walking, from, yeah, I mean, every mode that I can possibly get to. But at the end of the day, you know, I hope that people say, that leave the show, say, I had a great time. Because whether it was, you know, sometimes it's not even funny. Sometimes they don't even say it was the funniest thing ever. Sometimes they're just gonna go like, "Man, I haven't had an amazing time like that in 50 years." You know, and I hear that when I was younger, I'd hear that and go, "But was it funny? What the fuck, man?" Yeah. You know, now I don't ask, "Was it funny?" Fish. Now I'm like, "You did? Holy shit! 30 years and this is the best show, like, or best, you know, time you've had out. That's like, I'm grateful, but fuck, how boring is your life that this is it?" Or whatever the joke, whatever I say at that moment. But, you know, now I'm able to see see it from their perspective instead mm-hmm. of my own.
I know that feeling because, like, usually, like, when I have agents come and scout me, I always do bad on the shows they're at.
Right.
But the shows they're not at, I kill, you know? And I don't mean to change the subject. But
no, that's you.
But we were talking about...
You can ask me anything, by the way.
No, we are. But we were talking about you can't always believe everything you read on the internet. Alan Googled you and it said your favorite drink is sparkling ice blackberry, and he got you one, and you haven't even opened it. So
that's all bullshit. It's such bullshit. Sparkling, but you know what? I'm gonna drink it just because you got it for me. I'm gonna have some, bro.
That's very sweet of you.
So I was like, that's gotta be.
It's actually close though. I do drink a lot of.
I
drink a lot of dark berry stuff. Yeah. So that mm-hmm. is actually right.
Oh,
the dark berry stuff. The sparkling is usually
the sugar,
not.
The sugar thing is not
good.
Spiking your
well,
sugar.
Well, no. I normally do like Bai, which don't have sugar.
Stevia? I'm sorry?
No, Bai, the drink BAI.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So the Bai blackberry and the pomegranate. Okay, right. I'll drink the pomegranate if I'm okay with the little tart, because it's kind of tart.
It is.
And then the blackberry is... pretty sweet, so I'll do that. But what happened was, yesterday I had like me and my friend were hanging out, and he gave me an edible, and dude, I don't do those, and mm-hmm. it was just him. I woke up today feeling groggy. Mm-hmm. I need a cold brew, man. Yeah, I need caffeine to wake my ass up. So that's why I'm not a coffee guy.
One question I did have for you is because I've listened to other interviews because I try not to like ask the same questions, but I just wanted
you can ask whatever you want, bro.
I just wanted to, because like you said, when you first started as a comic, Eddie Griffin used to bump you at the store.
Everybody used to bump me. Everybody bumped everybody.
Yeah, and then like when you started doing it, and then like with the whole debate that was going on, I was thinking, how do you feel as a comics? Because like I try to put myself in that position, you know, like if you were to bump me, I would think in my head, okay, how do I want to be as good as you so I could not let you bump me? You know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Yeah, but that's not the mentality. See, when I first started, it was Dice Clay or mm-hmm. it was, you know, Paul Mooney, and it was people like that who would come in, Martin Lawrence and, you know, Arsenio Hall.
Yeah.
The difference was, you know, when those guys showed up, I was unbelievably blown away by the fact that I was in the same business as them. You know what I mean? I was a door guy at the Comedy Store, but I was in the same business. What?
Sure.
I've been on that same fucking stage.
Yeah.
I'm probably going to go on after like them. Like, holy shit. To me, and I thought the way you did. I felt like I can't fucking wait. Cannot wait. Till I get the chance to do what they're doing. Yeah. I cannot wait.
I didn't mean like bumping people. I meant like going after. So like.
No, I meant bumping people.
Oh, mm-hmm. yeah. I didn't mean
that's
that.
What I meant.
Oh, okay.
But it was done to me and I didn't think it was malicious.
Right.
Right? Because, okay, I thought differently than when I would bump people, they would say, why don't you just call? Right? Well, here's the problem. I called in and said to the Comedy Store, I might come in on Saturday. And they say, are you going to come in for sure?
Okay.
I say, I can't tell you 100% because, you know, mm-hmm. I'm going to dinner and some shit might happen at dinner and my friends might say, no, don't go to perform tonight. Let's go watch a movie or something. Mm-hmm. So, no, I can't tell you 100%. So then they said, well, we can't put you on schedule then. Because if we put you on the schedule and people call in and say, who's there? And we go, Carlos is coming in. Mm-hmm. And then you don't come in mm-hmm. and they want their money back. We got to give them their money back.
Right.
So... if you want to pop in, pop in. So that's what I would do instead. So I kind of tried to see if I could put my name on, but then I'd have to go and then I'd have to, you know, and I was just like, and to be quite honest with you, I was a very, 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 I was so focused at the time that I didn't see their anguish or uncomfortable feelings. I didn't notice it.
Yeah.
The other comics. I really didn't. It wasn't it just wasn't anything I was looking mm-hmm. at or looking for. I didn't think at the time, you know, hey, look at these people and they might feel weird, because I thought but I was them and I mm-hmm. paid my dues, you know. I mean, this is America. I'll give you an example. there's a big controversy about President Trump and whether what he said was racist when he told those four women of color, go back to where you came from. Right. In America, that's what happens, right? You're here long enough, you basically get to say, hey, I've been here longer than you. I'm fucking American more than you. I mean, whether you agree with that or not, the whole point of that analogy is that's kind of how comedy is in that structure, at the Comedy Store, in places where, you know, they have that hierarchy. Once you've, you know, when you've been on TV, you get in movies and you show up, a manager's going to run up to you and say, you want to go on?
It's just the way it is.
Me personally, I did it, didn't give a shit. And, you know, I was as abusive or more with the time than people before me. But I never thought I was doing it to such an extreme that it was going to lead to such animosity toward me. Yeah. But I do take responsibility for that. And, you know, I think that the whole joke stealing shit thing was bullshit, but their hatred of me for, you know, me bumping them and going on long, that was real.
Yeah.
And I can't, you know, because for anybody that's listening in right now that is yelling and screaming and saying it's proof and all that shit, listen, I've recorded every single show pretty much since 1994. If you have a comedian that you think has done a joke before I did, please tell me what comedian, tell me when they did it.
Yeah.
I literally have actual proof of when I did the shows. Like, they're archived. I can literally go back to 1998 or 6 or 5 or 2002 and go, oh, I remember when I first started telling that joke. And then I'll just go in the archives and look and at some point go, okay, I came up with it in the weekend I was performing in Arlington at this club, and that's where it is. And this is the day when did they start doing the joke.
Yeah.
So from that perspective, you know, it's always been a hard pill to swallow, because part of their hatred and animosity I get.
Yeah.
They just came from a different generation than I did. That was the, you know, in the early 2000s, which is about 18 years ago, is when the first crop of kids who pretty much got everything they ever wanted as children growing up came into probably Gen Xers or whatever that would be. Whereas my generation was different. My generation and before, we had this fire, this unbelievable desire to succeed, because we wanted shit as kids that our parents couldn't afford, whether it was Nikes, whether it was an Atari, whatever those things were, you know what I mean? We wanted them and we didn't get them. And so me and my friends, all of us, we were like, I'm not going to fucking be like that. When my kids ask for a pair of Air Jordans because all the other kids have them and my kid wants it, I'm going to be able to give my kid that Air Jordan. And so the generation right after me, they pretty much all grew up middle class. Parents had money, not a lot, but enough to get them the shit that they wanted. And so when I first started getting into the place where I could come and bump people at the Comedy Store, at the Improv, at the Laugh Factory, I started getting young comedians that said, well, I'm on the schedule, he's not. What the fuck? I don't get it. You know, they didn't understand the whole pay or dues shit. They didn't understand the whole, this is the way it works. They just said, wait a minute, I'm doing it right. I'm on the schedule. Why is this guy going on? And I didn't understand that at the time. I didn't get it, nor did I give a shit, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Because for me, it was like, oh, you want to come play? Go fuck yourself. I don't care. You know, I never really thought about it until, you know, they were given a chance to say something positive, negative, or neutral about me. And so many of them went negative that I went, okay, when one person thinks you're a dick, that's one thing. When everybody doesn't like you, there's got to be a fucking reason for that. And so I had to, you know, I had to do therapy. I had to look inside. It's been a long time, man. It's been a very difficult journey to get to where I'm at, because there have been moments of, you know, suicidal thoughts, not lying to you, little tiny moments of homicidal thoughts. There were, and when I say moments, bro,
like little moments,
I mean, are you a Star Trek fan?
At all?
Yeah.
Like the TV with the, in the space?
The original?
Yeah. The Star Trek.
Yeah.
The TV show.
Sure.
With Patrick Stewart.
Yeah. Not with Chris Pine.
Okay. So in the movie, in the movie with Patrick Stewart. I don't know which one it is, but it's the one where we battle the Borg.
Right.
And Data pretends to be on the side of the Borg.
Yeah.
But then he betrays the Borg, and then they kill the Borg. And then Captain Stewart asks him, was there ever time where you actually thought about joining the Borg? And he said, yes. And he goes, for like 0.04638 seconds. And he goes, trust me, for an android, that's an eternity.
Yeah.
So, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's how I mean. Like,
sure.
There are moments where I went, I'm going to fucking get a gun. And what the fuck are you thinking? Like, literally, like that. Mm-hmm. But there were, you know, there were times when I was just so down and so pissed. And, you know, it's really... It is a difficult thing to have put out as much material as I have, to have been doing this for 31 years, to have the fan base that I have, and for somebody that likes me to say to somebody else, you got to go see Carlos Mencia. He's funny as shit. And for somebody to just say one sentence and obliterate everything I've ever done in any way, shape, or form by just going, oh, whose jokes is he going to tell? Like, in just that one fucking sentence.
Yeah.
Just makes... everything I've ever done meaningless, inconsequential, petty, shitty, and it's difficult. It's difficult to be a comedian because that's what we live by.
Well, I think with me, because, like, you know, with my autism and stuff, I am very black and white. I don't see shades of gray.
Right.
You know, so, like, I'm talking to you, and, you know, I've met you a couple times, mm-hmm. and, you know, I could tell just by the energy you have a really good heart.
Right.
You know what I mean? And, so when I got bumped by Amy Schumer at the Improv when I first started, and because she was doing a Comedy Central roast, and the Improv was telling all the comics on the show, you're not going up because Amy. And I was like, I'll go up after Amy. I don't care.
Right.
You know what I mean? So right. I still did because I just want to make people laugh.
Sure.
You know, and that's why so I've had those suicidal thoughts too, especially because, like, I'm not big. I'm just just a feature comic.
Right. But
I'll go to Arizona. I just did Arizona last week.
Where?
The House of Comedy,
uh-huh.
Phoenix.
Yeah.
Have you done that room?
I have been to that room, believe it or not.
It is so awesome. Like, yeah. The energy.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. So I did it, and it cost me $300 just to get there because I can't drive, you know, because I got in a car accident. So I do Greyhound. And, you know, I just did 10 minutes. And it was awesome.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, that's what comedy means to me. Like, I'll lose money to make people laugh.
But you're different. Your mentality is different than the average comedian.
Is
today.
That good or bad?
Like, you know what? It is what it is, bro. You just have to live within the confines of who you are.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes, look, the longer you do this, the more abstract it becomes, and the more bizarre things you find that you just can't. You can't figure out. Oh, here's an example. I'll try to make this story quick. I have a buddy. His name is Juan Villarreal. Funniest unknown comedian that I've ever met to this date. Funniest guy on stage. When that guy hits, I mean, when he's on stage killing, there's nobody better. I met him when he was really, really young. And I wanted him to be on this show called, it was on HBO. It was Local Slam. And so I wanted him to be on the show. So I got him on the show. He did 5 minutes. But show airs about 6 months later. He calls me up and he goes, are you going to be performing in Corpus Christi anytime soon? I said, I'm not sure. Why? He said, well, if you do new material, because I was just there and I pretty much did your whole act. And I said, I'm sorry. What the fuck did you just say? And he goes, bro, they asked me to headline. I got 10 minutes. Like, you're my hero. So, you know, I did your shit. And my reaction was, I need to change my act anyway. Whatever. I don't care. Whatever. I legit was like, he's young, you know, yeah. Whatever. I didn't really care. Well, what happened was, because he did that, he got picked up to do a USO tour. In the USO tour, people started coming up to him and going, dude, you're fucking funny as shit. Did you know that Carlos Mencia is doing your shit?
Oh, my God.
So he was so insecure about it that he was like, that motherfucker instead of like saying no. So anyway, so that's that story. So cut to 20 years later, literally 20 years later, a guy walks up to him and goes, we're in Houston at the Improv. And we were in Houston at the where the Rockets play at the time. And so anyway, a guy comes up to him as I'm walking out of the bathroom and I hear the conversation. So I stop. So I can hear him, but I can't see him and they can't see me. So the kid says to Juan, look, I get that, you know, Carlos let you perform in this big ass arena with him, but how the fuck are you performing the guy that did your jokes? So he sits down and explains to him, Carlos is my idol, my mentor. He's not like me. I'm like him. I took my shit from him. My mannerisms, the fact that I say fuck the way I do, all of this stuff. I even took my act from him in the beginning. He's the dude. He goes, I can't believe that he lets me on stage after all the shit that I've done and I kind of sound like him. He's like the coolest dude ever. And the guy goes, yeah, I fucking hate him anyway. And I came around like, really? Are you serious? Like everything that you were told, he just told you is bullshit and you still fucking hate me? Like what the fuck? Do I need to suck dick? Like what do I need to do? How do I turn this shit around, guys? I don't get it. What the fuck? It's moments like that that just make you go as a person and made me say, there's nothing I can do.
Yeah.
Like, I just have to ride out this wave of whatever the fuck it is for however long it is. Keep my head down. Keep doing what I'm doing. Stay away from TV and movies for a minute. You know, get strong and be able to come back and deal with whatever bullshit I'm going to get when I come back, whatever that is. Because it'll happen.
So in the end, Carlos, Joe Rogan was a little harsh.
No, you know what's funny?
I was joking. I was making a joke.
I mean, listen. No.
I was making a complete joke.
No, I get it. No, I totally get it. I wish I knew. I wish I could tell you what the motivation was for that.
Yeah. Right.
You know what I mean?
I
wish I could tell you.
Sure.
All I know is this. Joe Rogan has never accused me of stealing his jokes.
There you go.
No. Never.
You were in Iraq.
He was accused of me, you know, doing other. I don't know what that means. No. I don't know where it comes from. I could understand somebody telling me that I took his shit.
Right.
I don't understand, you know, where the motivation comes for.
Yeah.
You didn't take my shit, but whatever. I don't get that. So I'm not, you know.
You know, I was watching a clip of you. I was very impressed when you were on the tour in Iraq.
Oh, yeah. And, I do a lot of tours.
Yeah.
In Iraq, I mean. In Iraq and Afghanistan. I don't know which one you're talking about. That's the beauty of it. I love performing for the troops, bro. I really do. For me, it's a way
you
of...
look like you did, yes.
It's a way of saying to America, thank you for letting me in. You know, I appreciate it because as my dad loves to point out, if I was in Honduras, I'd be the funniest fucker milking a cow. So I am grateful, you know. I do love it, but you know, that's just me. I enjoy going over there.
Nice.
That was your question. Just telling him.
No, what's the question?
No, well, I was saying I enjoyed it, and I wanted what he just answered it. He said he likes performing for the troops. And
are you going to ask him about Ben Stiller? This guy's favorite actor is Ben Stiller.
No, I was going to ask him that.
I'll tell you about Ben.
Go ahead.
He's amazing. No, he really is. Listen, the thing about Ben that most people never understood, I think, until maybe until a year and a half ago or 2 years ago when he directed that, the show on cable, you know, that like people really kind of went, wow, he's a very serious, good director. He took everything seriously. He was very professional. None of it was bullshit. And you know, unlike the majority of comedians who, when we act, are very undisciplined, and we rely so much on, can I improv? Can I do this? Can I add this? He would just break down everything that he was supposed to do and how he did it. And it was so great to work with somebody who is a comedic actor, but wasn't about like, hey, let's fuck around.
Yeah,
it was like, no. These words were written for a reason. They're funny the way they are. Let's execute them. Mm-hmm. And I was literally blown away at how, not just how serious, but how much of an actor and even a director he was during the stuff that we did, because, you know, there were times when he said, you know, wouldn't it be better? Would it be better if we shot it this way? Or what about this perspective? And sometimes those perspectives change on how they shot it. And it was based on him. He was, he was a very, very good person to be with as a comedian, so that you can see, like, if you want to act, you got to take this shit seriously. You can't just go up there and fuck around and be like, oh, I'll make it funny. It's not the way it works, man. Yeah, he's he's very, I was very impressed. I was very, 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 very impressed with him. He was, and so when he started doing serious directing, I was not in any way, shape, or form surprised or shocked. I went, yeah, most people don't know that that's, you know, so such a big part of what he does and who he is. But, you know, think about this, you know, guys like Jim Carrey have kind of been pigeonholed, right? Even though, you know, he's done some varied types of acting. Not Ben, you know, Ben can do, you know, he can produce a movie, he can direct a movie, he can be in the movie and the audience still take it in without looking at it as he's trying to do what, because, you know, he's been able to surpass that by a body of work. Which, you know, not a lot of people can do that, man. That's it's pretty fucking impressive. He's really, you know, he's really great. I think he's not going to be, until he gets older, passes away, I don't think that they're going to be appreciated, which is, you know, it happens a lot in our business.
Yeah, a lot. It's like Mitch Hedberg. No one really appreciated him until he died. Exactly. You know? And
No, that's not true. We appreciate it. And I'll tell you this because I was alive when he was alive.
I meant like his jokes and stuff. Like
We loved what he did. Okay. The thing about him was we kind of a lot of us were like, where is this material coming from?
Right.
Is it because he's on heroin? Or, like, if we took away the heroin, would it still be this funny and, you know, crazy and out there, but yet, you know, interesting and poignant?
Yeah.
I think that a lot of it was that. I think the problem was is that, you know, he never got to be as big of an audience, you know, attention grabber as we think he should have been or would have become. But that's because he was kind of young, you know what I mean?
And then, like, when he died, then, like, everyone's like, you know.
Correct. Well, because when he died, everybody went, who is this guy?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? So. Which was, he needed an event. It's sad that the event was his death. Yeah. You wish that that event could have been, you know, a special or whatever that was to take him to that other level. But we always, as we, and I mean the, comedians that were doing stand-up at the time that he was doing it, we always saw something brilliant in him. And, you know, we just kind of, like I said, I remember having discussions with people about, like, he's fucking crazy and weird and material is, like, abstract, but where is it coming from? So then when we would hear, oh, he's clean, we'd go, oh, shit, is this stuff going to be funny now? Like, is it all of a sudden going to go from this fucking awesome, crazy, quirky shit to, like, I was sitting down at the mall the other day, like, oh, keep doing heroin. This is horrible shit. You know what I mean? Because I grew up with, I mean, I didn't grow up in comedy, but when I started doing stand-up, I kind of got into what was going on a little bit. And it's kind of like following the career of Pryor. You know, with Pryor, especially his later specials, some really fucked up shit would happen in his life. And all of a sudden, I was like, oh, he's doing a special. Yeah. Oh, I shot my car and I, you know, oh, fuck, he shot his car. You know what I mean? He lit himself on fire. Oh, new special. Yeah. So, you know what I mean? Tragedies. Here comes the jokes. And you would hope that, like, that didn't have to happen. But, you know, some of us. As comedians operate that way, you know what I mean? Really bad shit happens in our life and we're able to go out there and kind of like put it to the audience, you know?
The last question I had for you is, I don't even know if you could talk about it, but you have something that works called Judging Carlos.
Judge Carlos. Right.
Can you like share what that's about? Is it a TV show or a TV movie?
We don't know what it is right now. Believe it or not, I came up with Judge Carlos because it wasn't even like a character. It wasn't even a character like that. It was that, and I could still do it. I just feel like it's old and I don't want to do shit like that anymore on stage. I mean,
yeah.
I would see these court cases go through, and like people that were guilty were mm-hmm. not found guilty, and people that should never have win won. And I would just go, what? So then I would go, Judge Carlos would fix that shit. And then I would just give my opinion.
Yeah.
It wasn't like some abstract thing. It was just me. I would just go like, if I was a fucking judge, you know what I mean? And then everybody, you know, and then people were like, you mean Judge Carlos? And I'm like, okay, Judge Carlos, whatever. Like, not the point of the joke. You know what I mean? So it just kind of grew. And then somebody recently said, let's shoot a couple of things and let's come up with a show. And, you know, here's what I think. I think that if there weren't court shows, like if there wasn't the People's Court and mm-hmm. Judge Judy and Judge this and Judge that, I would probably have a show where, you know, I was a judge. And, you know, it would be a show like that, but from a comedic standpoint, you know, from a funny standpoint. But those shows kind of already have that. Like, you know, not that they're exquisitely funny, but they have humor to them already, you know. And you know, some of it is about the law and all that kind of crap. And you know, so. Yeah. But, I love doing Judge Carlos because court cases come through all the time that I'm just like, what the fuck? What are you serious? Like, yeah. You know what I mean? That kind of thing. So, and just, it's inspiring. Like I really did think that after being a comedian for as long as I've been a comedian, I would run out of shit to say or not be inspired. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, and only because, you know, when I was young, I wanted to change the world. I'm 51 and now I just realized that I'm just, how do I put it? If there's a war between heaven and hell, it's been going on from the dawn of time.
Yeah.
And I feel like that. Like, I'm in a war with stupidity and lack of common sense. And, you know, I'm going to sway one person here or there, an audience here or there. But at the end of the day, I'm just keeping balance. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm just making sure that it doesn't go too far in one direction. But that's all I can do. You know, I'm not going to make it better. I'm not going to stop stupidity. I'm not going to tell a joke that's so funny that, you know, half of the country is going to be inspired to go get a GED or whatever the fuck it is, you know, that they need to get or want to get or should get or whatever it is. It's just not what it is. You know, I'm just going to change one person's mind here, make somebody think something else here. 10 people think I'm funny and they don't think I'm smart. And one person thinks I'm a genius and all that kind of shit. You just go through it. But I'm inspired on a daily basis with what's going on today, because the one thing that's happening in America that's so good for my kind of comedy, or at least it's easy for me to take advantage of, is our inability to see truth for what it is.
Yeah.
So I get to be able to say, somebody told you this shit was yellow? Well, let's go through the fucking colors of the rainbow. You know what I mean? And all of a sudden, it's like, it's fucking red. Well, you're right, it's red. It's so cool to be able to do that.
Yes.
It's right. So fun to be able to do that and to be able to point that stuff out. So it's a really good time to be a comedian mm-hmm. for everybody. I think the hard part is that there's no formula anymore.
Right.
The good part and the shitty part about being a comedian in the 80s, mid-90s.
The bloom, the comedy bloom.
I don't know if it was a bloom as much as it was, there was a formula, right?
Yeah.
The formula was, no matter what kind of comedy you do, you better have a 5-minute set that's clean, that doesn't deal with McDonald's or Wendy's or Walmart or Kmart, because you're not going to be able to do jokes out that, and have your 5-minute set ready so that if the Tonight Show called or the Late Show called or whoever that was, you had that set ready to go. That mm-hmm. clean, perfect, funny, introductory, I'm Carlos Mencia and this is who I am. Mm-hmm. Boom, 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 good night. Problem with that, it required one person to see you perform and want to give you that opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? So you were dependent on
that one
person. That one person. Now you had to hire people that knew that person, that got that person out, you know, because you can't call the booker of the Tonight Show and say, hey, blah, blah, blah. You got to have somebody that knows that guy or, you know, some agent or whatever it is. So you get to that point. Today, you can literally produce your own TV show without anybody telling you what to do, how to write it, what actors to have in it, what to put in it. You can produce whatever you want and put it on a network called YouTube or whatever it is. It doesn't matter. You know,
that's great.
That's the difference. Those people don't rely on, you know, the guy from ABC to say, you're funny, I'm going to give you a TV show, George Lopez or Carlos Mencia or whoever it is. The shitty part is there are so many places to see comedy now that it's very rare that you have what those guys used to have, which was Gary Shandling goes on The Tonight Show, kills it. Somebody shakes his hand on the way out and says, I hope you're ready for what's going to happen tomorrow. And the next day, phone calls up the ass come that we want to give him a show. We want to meet with him. We want to talk to him, blah, blah, blah. You know, that is not, that just doesn't happen the same way anymore. Right. I mean, you know, you can, what happens today is Angela Johnson puts, you know, Bonquiqui on and The Nail Lady, and it gets traction and, you know, she starts selling tickets, ends up on, I think she was on Mad TV for a couple of years, you know, and that 5-minute set propelled her to get to this. So people will say, well, see, you could do it. Okay. How many comedians do you think have put 5 minutes of material on YouTube?
Yeah.
Thousands?
A lot, yeah.
Okay, so let's just round it out to 1,000. It's more than that. But if 1,000 of them put shit up there and one of them blew the fuck up, like huge, God, it's 0.0001%. It's nothing. It's insignificant.
Yeah.
So that's the difference. Now, you don't need anybody to tell you what to do, but you got to go through the screaming voices of every comedic thing on YouTube, every comedic person on YouTube, every comedic person on Google, on Amazon, on blah, 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 on blah, 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 doing the same shit. You know what I mean? It's like podcasts. I mean, there was a time when, you know, when you being able to say, I'm doing a podcast and I'm on the spectrum and I have Asperger's, you'd be the only person doing some shit like this.
Yeah.
And people would be like, fuck, dude, have you heard of that guy? Blah, blah. And they wouldn't even know what you do. Just the fact that you can have that. Today, you're one of a billion podcasts.
Yeah. It took you 6 years to get you on here.
You see what I'm saying? and by the way, I wanted to do it the whole time. Interestingly enough, I've never said no to any of this stuff.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's a different environment. It's a different place in time. It's a more self-centered place in time than ours, because even though when we got to be kind of self-centered dicks, we did it, we bumped people, I did anyway, others before me did, but we were also on the way to get there, okay with, you know, paying our dues, so to speak. We were like, I get it, I'm an opener, I ain't nothing, I ain't shit, you know, well, I will be one day.
Yeah.
It was something to motivate us. I know, today, it's a different environment. And you know, I think that a big part of my success as an older comedian right now, for me to be able to sell out a club like Brea, right, which I did a couple of weeks ago or about a month ago, whatever it is.
The new one?
Yeah, the new one.
Oh, that's a beautiful venue.
Yeah. So for me, I haven't put out a special in 8 years.
Yeah.
Going on 9. My last special was in 2010. So for 8 fucking years, I haven't put anything out, and I can still sell those tickets because of, you know, how much I've kept up my stand-up roots. That's pretty astonishing for me. You know, I look at it that and go, wow, that's a huge accomplishment. You know, take that for what it's worth, and look at it from that perspective. I just I think that, you know, the journey to get there is something that you guys, as young comedians, should understand, that it's just you have control over so much. You go on stage and you're great and you kill it and you rock it, and instead of being funny when those guys aren't there, you need to be consistently funny or find a way to make it so that you kill no matter what. And I have not seen the difference between your shows in one or the other, but just venturing into my into the realm of I've seen a lot of shit in this world and stand-up wise. Mm-hmm. When somebody comes to see you perform, people that know you are so afraid that they're not going to like you that they tell you that you should do all of this stuff so that they like you, or to change this or to change that, mm-hmm. or to move this or to move that, or to pay attention to this or to pay attention to that, or to get this or to get that. I would say to you, dude, don't ever do a show ever. Ever do a show for people that come to see you perform that are in our business.
Yeah.
The shit that they think is funny, personally, is never.
Wow.
Never the shit that everybody else thinks is funny.
That's wow. nice.
Think about it. They've seen a billion comedians.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, they're like us. They want to hear a joke like the fucking worst, wretched joke that is going to make audiences go, hey, fuck you. But they're in the back like, now that's funny. You're like, what? You know what I mean? Yeah.
Sure.
Do it.
Sure.
Well, Carl, always do it for the audience, bro.
Carlos,
get up on stage, do it for the audience, and I promise you the next time that they come to see you perform, ignore that they're there.
Thank you.
Do your show for the crowd. You will kill it. And then they're going to come up to you and go, dude, that guy was funny. You were really funny. They because they won't care about how they feel. That's not mm-hmm. their job.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Their job isn't to put somebody on that they like. Their job is to put somebody up there that the world is going to like.
I want to mention your dates because we got the light, so we got to get out of here.
Right. Okay.
These are just your California dates. You're going to be at the Ice House this weekend, July 19th through the 20th. Tickets at icehouse.com. And then you're going to be at the Irvine Improv in September 5th through the 8th. Tickets are on irvineimprov.com. Of course, you have other dates.
Just go to carlosmencia.com.
Carlosmencia. Yeah. And that's where the folks at home can follow.
That's where everything is at, carlosmencia.com/carlosmencia. All right. And if you don't know what I'm saying, you're just not an internet person anyway. So, /Carlos? I don't get it. Yeah. So, anyway.
Well, Carlos, thank you so much for doing the show.
Yes, sir.
I want you to know from the bottom of my heart, you've helped a lot of comics and you've helped me just by doing this interview. So, thank you so much.
I appreciate it. Me as well. I listened to this. I was trying to soak this up with my, you know,
ADHD.
See, I don't even know what I have.
It's probably ADHD. Listen, you'll know. Okay, yeah, so really quick, because I know we got to go. Okay. But you'll know. So here's the test. It's an easy test. No, I won't give it to you. I'm going to tell you what it is. They're going to put you in front of a computer where numbers are coming down. Not too fast.
Okay,
slowly. And they're going to go, whenever you see a 1, just push this space bar. And if you really have ADHD, you're going to push that space bar about 1,000,000 times.
Oh.
Yeah.
Because... here's what's going to happen. You're going to have your hand over it, and you're going to get anxious. And you're going to, where is it? Where? And then you're going to hit it without wanting to, because your brain just... And then one's going to pass, and you're not going to see it.
Oh.
Because you're going to be thinking about other shit. You're going to go, what the fuck is this? Hey, where did I leave my keys? You know what I mean? And so you'll find out. Sure. There's a test.
Sure.
Ask your doctor.
I'm going to speak.
So let me know what the test says, because I'd be so interested. No. Because I know I don't have it, and I did the test, and it was so, I was like, how the fuck did you fail this test?
Yeah.
Dude, a star comes down, hit a fucking button. Yeah, like, what are you doing? And I'm watching him, and he's fucking hitting the button, and I know it's coming. I'm like, dude, relax. I was like, holy shit, you're fucked up, dude.
Well, Carlos,
hopefully you'll be fucked up.
Carlos, oh, my God. Buddy.
Thank you.
Bye, guys.
Thank you.
Carlos
Mencius.
Bye.
You're listening to Razor Riffs with Keith Razor and Alan Lee, right here on LA Talk Radio.